Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, last night, this is an overused word in the media business, but it really was a bombshell. That Politico obtained a draft opinion of the Dobbs case. This was the case that potentially is set to overturn Roe v. Wade, Supreme Court to decide that case by the end of June, but at the end of their term. But perhaps now they need to issue that opinion much sooner than they initially had planned to issue that opinion, a controversial opinion, a precedent-setting, potentially precedent-setting opinion like that, usually issued closer to the end of term. But after this leak that seems to be a legitimate document, perhaps the court has to move more quickly in order to maintain its legitimacy. And, of course, the upshot of the leak, as most of you have probably heard, the draft opinion, this is now back from February, is Justice Alito writing for a majority of the court, five justices. Justice Roberts's position unclear. But Alito and four of his colleagues moving in no uncertain terms to overturn Roe v. Wade and put it back to the states. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, I found out late last night. I was shocked. I just want to know who leaked the memo and why did they leak it?
Well,
I mean, that's,
you know, dollars to donuts. It's going to be a clerk for one of the dissenting justices. And there was some chatter online. A person named Amit Jain, clerks for, or Jan, Amit Jan, clerks for Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor, the wise Latina. As a Yale student, Jan or Jain blasted Yale for supporting Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Jain was quoted in a 2017 Politico piece by Josh Gernstein. And it was Gernstein who got a copy of the draft opinion that Politico published last night.
Oh, okay.
So that's one theory.
Theory, but why did they do it? To prepare because the midterms are coming up or what, you know, people at the primary, you know, today in Indiana and Ohio, and maybe their vote, the Republican vote means more, the Democratic vote means more because you want to have abortion rights in your state. I mean, everything happens for a reason.
Why?
And today, people are voting.
Why would a clerk, perhaps with the nod of the justice for whom that clerk works, why would they release that draft opinion now? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Here's Josh Gernstein on with Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes. They look alike to me. I can't tell. But talking about obtaining this draft opinion.
It's not a final opinion. It's a draft opinion. It was circulated in the court as a first draft by Justice Alito in February, dated February 10th. So it is possible there have been some changes since then. But it's our best understanding of at least where the court stood at that time, which is about 2.5 months after arguments in this pivotal Mississippi abortion case.
Mm-hmm. And the impact of the leak on the legitimacy of the court? That was put to Gernstein, among others. Here's what Josh Gernstein, the Politico reporter who published this draft opinion, had to say.
Well, I mean, there have been leaks out of the court before, perhaps not of this magnitude, but we've all gotten kind of used to on these big decisions, such as Obamacare, such as this abortion decision, to hints, body English, I might call it. There's a nuanced reading of editorials that appear in different places, places like the Wall Street Journal editorial page, where you can often see indications that maybe the court is moving one way and conservatives aren't happy about it. You do see that kind of dialogue, but never accompanied by an actual opinion. So I do think that this is groundbreaking, and it does take the court into new territory. It would certainly be very interesting to know what Chief Justice John Roberts thinks about this, even if he doesn't agree with this opinion. What does he think about whether this causes the court to be viewed as a political institution by some people? That's what we're going to have to see how it plays out over the next couple of months as this continues.
Yeah. So Justice Roberts, who is always sticking his finger in the wind to gauge public opinion, if, you know, putatively to protect the integrity of the court. What does this do to the integrity of the court?
Governor Pritzker tweeted out, "Hell no, exclamation point. In Illinois, we trust women. We cannot let their most profound and personal rights be violated."
He's irrelevant. We're talking about the Supreme Court. We're not talking about some hack politician at the state level. This is going to go back to the states. The states knew this was coming, which is why you've seen so much action at the state level. The repeal of parental notification here, the infanticide bill in California, and on the opposite side, the pro-life legislation banning abortions after 15 weeks in Florida, going even further than that in Oklahoma. So there was always an understanding that this was likely going to go back to the state. So the histrionics from hacks like Jelly Belly, sort of irrelevant. Oh, yeah. The integrity of the court, not irrelevant. Andy McCarthy tweeted out, "If this story is true, the court should issue its opinion right away. Otherwise, the disgraceful leak wins. I would say that if my side lost, if we lose the integrity of the court's process, we lose the court. That should be intolerable to all of us who live in this country." And by the way, it's not just conservatives like McCarthy. Jeffrey Toobin kept his hands to himself long enough to offer this view on CNN last night.
"There has never been a leak anything like this. There's never been a leak of a vote, much less an actual opinion, much less in a case of this significance. It's really going to be an interesting question, putting aside so much about this, what this means for the institution of the Supreme Court, you know, what it means for the respect that the justices and the court's decisions are held. The idea that a decision of this magnitude could leak is really a shattering experience for the justices and the court. And I really don't know institution's going to recover."
Well, my immediate reaction was, when you subordinate the law to political ideology, what restraint will professional ethics have? None. And so that's what you saw from whoever leaked this. Alex in Hinsdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. My take on this, as soon as I heard it, was whether it's you don't like something that happens with law enforcement, so you allow your side to tear up American cities, you don't like a decision, then you justify all means necessary by breaking federal law, by leaking this out, and that's a pattern. If you don't like something, they feel that they can just break the law, they can go against all social norms. And my last point would be, when people figure out that this isn't the middle ground that that many have in America about a pregnancy at 3 or 4 weeks, you've got the crazies now in New York, in Maryland, and as you stated, Dan, in California, that up to 20, I believe, 3 weeks after birth, they could kill the baby. That's a murder. In any society, that's a murder. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for the call, Alex.
And Dershowitz said that, you know, he thought the liberal law clerk leaked it to try to change the theory, to try to, to change the opinion on this.
Obviously. And you have the mob show up dutifully outside the Supreme Court last night with their chants and their, quote unquote, hastily made signs. Right. Hastily made. Sure, they were hastily made. Yeah, that's exactly what they're trying to do, is put pressure on whoever they think they can put pressure. Perhaps Kavanaugh, perhaps no one, certainly Roberts, who is more sensitive to public pressure.
Mm-hmm. The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Guests and
all. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we were talking about the draft opinion that was leaked from the Supreme Court to Politico that indicates Justice Alito writing for the majority, five justices, to overturn Roe v. Wade. In no uncertain terms, we hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. It's time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives. That's from the draft opinion that is published in Politico. And so the question, if that opinion is the opinion the Supreme Court ultimately issues and Roe is overturned and returned to the states, particularly as a pro-lifer, but not limited to pro-lifers, are you excited about this occurrence or are you nervous about it?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, or you could text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I know what Pritzker is going to do. This is his whole campaign ad. From now on, every campaign ad is going to be about women's rights. And they're gathering this morning at 8:30 to have a press conference with other state lawmakers to determine what they're going to do and how they're going to handle this moving forward.
Does that make you nervous? So if Jelly Belly wants to run a campaign for the next 7 months, 6 months on abortion?
It makes me nervous that more Democrats are going to get out and vote. People that would, you know, they don't like Pritzker. They don't like what he did with COVID. You know, my body, my choice. No, not for the last 2 years. Now he's all up in arms. It makes me very concerned that there's certain liberal women that are going to now vote that would just sit home.
Is this going to whip people into a frenzy, or is it just going to whip those who are already in a frenzy into a more substantial frenzy? You think that the people who don pea hats, now they're animated to participate in politics? Those that are carrying signage and post their pronouns on their social media accounts and so forth, now the radical left is radicalized. This is going to have a huge impact, because this is what Axelrod, professional liar, red diaper baby, David Axelrod, and others on the left want you to believe. This is what they're trying to foment because they have such a problem right now. And they think, ironically, pun intended, that this may be a lifeline.
Our state senator, Sarah Feingold, told CBS News that now they have to worry about, you know, bordering towns that are going to be banning abortions and how we're going to handle the influx here. I mean, oh, my God. It's a moneymaker, right, Dan? It's some tax. You can tax this stuff, right, somehow?
So, have we heard from any Republicans in this state yet? We're going to talk to gubernatorial candidate Jesse Sullivan at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. We'll see what he has to say. Have we heard from Republicans? You know, those pro-life Republicans. You know, the pro-life Republicans, the ones you go see at events and they tell you they're pro-life, and you get a flyer in the mail and it says, I'm pro-life on there. Have you heard from them? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Excited or nervous?
I'm nervous.
Why?
Because people that I think would normally sit home during the primary, during the general election, are going to vote now because of this.
Yeah.
To keep Illinois, you know, the abortion mecca that it's going to become.
It's already there. Yeah. There's virtually nothing more other than killing children until they're able to work outside the home that Illinois could do to make this a more pro-death state. So then what else you got? You're going to reaffirm the culture of death in Illinois? Well, go ahead. It's going to make Illinois something? What are you talking about? Super majorities of pro-abort socialists in both chambers. You got Jelly Belly in the governor's mansion, even if you had a Republican in the governor's mansion, because of the surrender Republican non-leadership in the House and Senate, you're not going to turn over the House and Senate. So what are you talking about again?
I wonder what Irvin's reaction is to this.
Also, you know, the loudest doesn't necessarily mean the largest.
Okay.
So you look at a polling on this, and it's a small percentage of voters whose vote is animated by the life issue. you know, solely. And so, and by the way, that tends to lean towards pro-lifers whose votes, if you're talking about the cohort of people who vote strictly on abortion, pro-lifers tend to outnumber pro-aborts.
Okay.
But you don't hear from them, so you feel like, oh my gosh, this is going to open the floodgates and all the orcs from Middle Earth are going to be rushing to the polls. Yeah. There'll be a lot of hysteria in the next week, and whenever the opinion is rendered, they'll try to, again, capitalize on that. Can they sustain that for 6 months when in many states the law really is not much in controversy and the balance of political power is not much in controversy, so the law is not much, there's not much chance the law is going to be changed in the short term? And people are short-term thinkers, generally speaking, particularly with their vote.
You're going to love this statement. I won't read the whole thing. I won't bore you, but Mayor Lightfoot released a statement. Make no mistake, this decision will reverse the gains that women have made in the workplace.
It's just cut and paste.
I know. And other aspects of their life.
It's cut and paste. Yeah. You know, I could issue a press release on their behalf because I know what they're going to say. And so do you. The question is not what the left says. What do pro-lifers say? What do those politicians who preen pro-life when there is no consequence, particularly in Illinois and Chicagoland in the suburbs, preen pro-life when there is no consequence, there's no need to make an argument. It's just a bullet point on a flyer. What do they say and do now? Tony, Downers Grove.
Well, Dan, you have too much faith that this isn't going to go anywhere, and because you've already said it. It's what are the Republicans going to do? And they do nothing, and that's the problem. And I don't care if there's more pro-life people sitting at home. The problem is that the left puts this front and center, and they don't forget about it, and the Republicans do, and then the Republican base doesn't do anything about it. And that's the issue we have.
Well, you're talking specifically about Illinois, but it's
No, I'm talking.
Well, it varies. It varies widely from state to state, Tony, as we're seeing play out at the state level, state to state.
No, I don't disagree with you, but I can't. You've bitch slapped me about this before, but we'll see. We'll see what happens in states like Texas and other states where they've made some of these radical changes that mm-hmm. people believe are radical because people don't pay attention past the surface issue. And the surface that always comes to top is just the, hey, it's a woman's right, and they're taking away health care. And those are the main talking points, and nobody digs beyond those.
Yeah.
Nobody goes deeper than that.
Well,
that's the problem.
Well, here's the thing, Tony. That's true of some people. I don't think you're moving a lot of opinions on this issue, generally speaking. Although people's hearts and minds change. But I mean, generally speaking, particularly through the political process, over time, it has to be personal, usually. But something else, in places like Florida and Oklahoma and Texas and Mississippi, they've had fights on this. They've had political fights on this. They've had debates. Mm-hmm. So, and you've had pro-life Republicans make arguments. Let me say that a little bit more slowly because I know this is not a term we're familiar with here. Arguments. They've made the case to respect the sanctity of human life. They've made the case for reasonable restrictions on abortion at the state level. And, you know, they've had leadership from a governor. They've had leadership from a legislature. And, you know, a lot of those legislators in other states are no more courageous than the legislators in this state. They are at the back of the parade. And so in many other states with many other electorates, the pro-life argument is winning the day because it's been made. Not here, but elsewhere. Greg in Schaumburg.
Hey, Dan and Amy, great show. Dan, we talked at one point about the concept of stare decisis, and you mm-hmm. said that this is a case that could go back and be based on stare decisis. And what I was hoping that Alito would have done, and it seems like he has not done, is reference first principles of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And thus, what it seems to me he's done is just punted back to the states. And it seems to me like what you have just done is reinforced the notion that it is a political issue that will effectively be determined by, you know, the state issues. And so consequently, you're going to hear probably New York, all of the blue states are going to be pro-abortion. I'm not as optimistic as you are that the right to life people are going to prevail. So could you address the issue of how it could have been written from a first principles point of view?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Thanks for the call, Greg. I mean, the what Alito says, at least in part of the draft opinion, let me quote from him. Roe expressed the feeling that the 14th Amendment was the provision that did the work, but its message seemed to be that the abortion right could be found somewhere in the Constitution and that specifying its exact location was not of paramount importance. Pretty sarcastic, but also salient. And so what he's saying is it's not our place. This is a place for the states and their duly elected representatives. And, you know, you still have cases at the state level that will be leveled up and challenged, you know, as we learn more and argue more about when exactly life begins, you know, as the science advances, as states go, you know, completely over the edge the way that California is attempting to do at present. But, you know, I think the first principle here is this our place? And we're saying there is no right to abortion in the Constitution. And so Roe should have never been decided the way it was decided. It's one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history, and it should be repealed, and the balance of power should be reset. And so to some extent, if you believe in federalism, which I know you do, Greg, that is, and you believe in the three co-equal branches, that is a first principle argument that Alito's making, just not the one that you want him to make. And I appreciate it because, of course, I agree with your argument. But I also recognize the context in which Alito is making and the majority is making this decision. And the context is signaling that this is not the court's place. That was bad law. This is not the court's place. Reset the table.
He went on to say Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences.
Yes, and of course we know this. I mean, for all those who, you know, where the populace is. Well, the reason this has been a pitched battle for 50 years is because the Supreme Court in 1973 usurped its
powers.
Well, usurped the authority of the states by wading into this and manufacturing a right that doesn't exist in the Constitution, as Alito outlines. Tony, Southside.
Good morning, Lammy. Good morning, Dan. Hey, Dan, I have a question for you. So the person that leaked this, obviously against federal law, and leaked it to the Politico, is there any kind of repercussions from the law that can go after that person, even though Politico might use the But now does Politico have to give up that that source? They don't have to, huh?
No.
Under a law investigation?
No. They don't have to disclose their source. Thanks for the call, Tony. But, I mean, at least professional repercussions, termination.
Yeah, they can't let this go on, you know.
Disbarment.
You can't let this fly over the plate. Come on.
But that person would have to be identified. Or, since they're being so courageous, according to so many on the left, they should come forward and...
Yeah, they'll be hailed a hero. There'll be a parade for the person.
And own it. Yeah, that's right.
We got a text message. Am I right that the people who spent 2 years supporting illegal executive mandates that violated bodily autonomy and freedom of movement are now outraged about the prospect of abortion laws being actually legislated at the state level?
Yeah, well,
yeah, I mean for two
the left likes autocrats when they're there autocrats, and they like legislatures when they're there legislatures. So, I mean, again, this is all ends justify the means. So the law, professional ethics, the branches of government, I mean, these are all just to be used as spare parts whenever needed to advance the flag, or discarded if not needed, or if an impediment. Pat in Lockport.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I have just a couple of thoughts. I personally would be thrilled to death to have Roe versus Wade reversed. However, as I'm listening to you guys talk, are we going from racism and critical race theory that has failed, a mass vaccination that has failed, the Durham investigation is rolling along, the Hunter investigation is rolling along, Afghan was a total disaster, mm-hmm. we're sending billions of dollars of equipment to Ukraine, never had any finger in their other wars, but we have to protect the money laundering country of the universe. And furthermore, the United States is the one of seven countries that has federally legalized abortion. Now, I want to see just exactly how this works. And we are going to see all the people, Republican, liberal, Democrat, whatever, who think that legalizing, continuing to legalize the murder of innocent individuals is not the murder of individuals that are defenseless. This is going to be a damn joke because the diaper-wearing dimwit in D.C. has done such a pathetic job making a mess out of the United States of America. Now they have to have another mantra. Let's promote the killing.
All right, thanks for the call, Pat. Larry Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just find it incredibly ironic and maybe a little hypocritical. The far left has been screaming for 2 years to obliterate Title IX, to tell women that they can only do what men tell them to do. And now all of a sudden, my God, women's rights is at the top of their parade.
Thanks for the call, Larry. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Yeah, I'm optimistic with this because, you know, the culture is changing. I mean, there was that poll or there was that information I got the other day that the younger generation, they're not having sex as much. I forget what it was. More of them had a drink than sex or drugs than sex. So this may not be as important to them.
One usually leads to the other. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the left is getting exposed. They are grotesque with the way with their reactions to this. The immediacy of it, the fact that there's no other concern for any constitutional rights or federalism or anything. I mean, they are a foul and filthy temple, leftism is, especially in today's incarnation of it. I mean, they are just horrible.
Thanks.
I say that a lot. But
thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. I agree with Frank. I'm optimistic about it, too, and happy to have the political fight and happy to make the arguments and happy that people are going to be compelled to discuss this, because I know it makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but it shouldn't. It's too important.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, updating this case out of Lyons Township High School that we've been talking about for the last several shows. This was the beating that took place in the hallway at Lyons Township South, where a sophomore there named Heaven Washington pounded a freshman, sending her ultimately to the hospital, although not from the school, as we understand it. And the question is, what, if any, disciplinary action was going to be taken by the school and Western Springs Police, per the school saying they were investigating the matter and in doing so in consultation with the Western Springs Police Department. And remember, this was caught on video, so this is why it's become such a high-profile case, in part. And so late yesterday, charges were filed by the Western Springs Police Department against Heaven Washington. She'll be charged with battery, a Class A misdemeanor, according to Police Chief Brian Buds.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA. than a quick comment. And I honestly believe if Westcook News, myself, and others did not press the police chief on why haven't charges been filed, that there would be no charges filed. Because when I talked to the police chief yesterday, Brian Buds, first of all, he lied to me and said that, oh, no, we've been in contact with the victim and her family. Said, we've interviewed a lot of people. And I said, well, who have you interviewed? I mean, have you reached out? Have you talked to the victim? And he said, oh, yeah, we have. Well, I checked with the victim's father. That was a lie. He and his daughter have yet to speak to anyone at the Western Springs Police Department.
Yeah, in fact, I understand the assertion was made that the parents of the girl who was battered were not interested in pressing charges, and that was completely false because they had at that time not been contacted by Western Springs Police. Mm-hmm.
And her father is a police officer. We're not telling you where, but he is a police officer himself. So he knows what a battery charge is, and he knows what aggravated assault is.
You don't need to be a police officer to know that.
But here's the thing. So then, because a similar situation happened in Skokie with three teenagers, 14 and 15, beat up a 14-year-old. The kid had to go to the hospital. They stepped in right away. And I called Skokie, and I said, police. And I said, was this a racial issue? They said, no. But I let them know what was going on in Western Springs. They saw the video, too, and they were shocked that Western Springs had not arrested her right away. Not even that day, but even 4 days later.
My understanding was that the investigation didn't really commence until yesterday because the police chief was out of town last week.
And so was his PIO, but who cares? There's 19 other police officers in the Western Springs Police Department who could have arrested her.
Well, I understand, right? I mean, the police don't stop doing their job because the chief is out of town. So it's a bit curious. I also, and we did, by the way, invite the police chief to be on the show. It's also interesting to me what, if any, conversations Western Springs PD had with the school, because one of the things we still don't know, although we thought we knew, I reported what we believed to be what we believed to have occurred and was going to be announced yesterday, which is that Heaven Washington would be expelled from Lyons Township. That cannot be confirmed at this point. It's unclear. That was the scuttlebutt on Friday, but obviously there was no announcement by the school yesterday, and it's unclear whether or not she was in class or is welcome back to the school.
Who was in class, according to our sources, was the boy who recorded the video, and according to state criminal code, knowingly recording video of a battery with intent to disseminate that video is an aggravating factor. That elevates the battery to a class 3 felony. It was a boy.
Not on one of the videos. I think there's multiple videos. On one of the videos, it was a girl.
Well, people that recorded it, is he still in school?
The statement that was issued by Western Springs, the 16-year-old youth was arrested after an investigation stemming from her role in physical altercation, which resulted in injury on April 27th. The follow-up investigation confirmed the youth defendant intentionally and without legal justification confronted a 14-year-old female student, proceeded to physically strike the victim multiple times, pulled her by the hair while the victim was on the floor, which resulted in visible injuries that required medical treatment. And the investigation remains ongoing, but they moved to at least charge Class A misdemeanor battery. Right. And now the question becomes, well, there's a couple of questions. One is, what is the school going to do? And two is, is she being undercharged? Is this a clear case where a felony charges of an aggravated battery are more appropriate? And if not, then why not, based on the legal standard for said charges?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm-hmm. Be interesting to get reaction from anybody affiliated with LT, too, or, you know, other schools where this sort of stuff is happening. Obviously, it's not limited to LT. The story in the patch.
trying to play catch up?
The local story in the patch by this, clown propagandist, you know, who's always on the side of the government and the left, or in this case, the school district. here's how it was characterized by David Giuliani. This guy is, you know, real trash. So if you're reading the patch locally for quality news about what's happening in your community, you should reconsider. Here's the opening graph. A fight between two girls at Lyons Township High School may result in criminal charges. Oh, was it a fight between two girls?
Little B slap? No, I don't think that was that. I mean, she ripped her earring out of her ear.
Well, was it a fight between two girls, or was it one girl who descended and kicked the snot out of the other girl? Yeah. This wasn't a fight. It makes it sound like it was sanctioned by the WBA.
Or that they were mutual combatants. No, she was jumped in the hallway while she was walking out of her class.
One girl was attacked by the other girl. That's why it may result in criminal charges and did result in criminal charges, you Dumas, David Giuliani. But that's how they do it. That's how they do it to try to round out the edges of any of these stories when they don't particularly like the truth of the story. Got to run this by the old patch disinformation governance board, I suppose. And your conversation with Buds, the police chief in Western Springs, said he had talked to the victim's family, hadn't yet. But the upshot was that he was disturbed by the incident. He was taking it seriously. And then yesterday you got charges filed. Your overall impression of the handling of it from your conversation with them?
I mean, honestly, there would not be charges if West Quick News did not investigate the story, did not make this.
Why do you think that? Video.
Because it's a racial issue. Because the
suspect
is black
and the victim is
white.
Yeah, no. But why do you think that Western Springs police wouldn't have brought charges? What leads you to believe that?
Because I just think they wanted this to be a school matter. That is the impression that I got, and not a criminal matter. But it could be both. As it was in Skokie, and I pointed out to him, you know, they were on it. You have an officer assigned to that school where this attack happened.
Yeah.
Why didn't you just drag her out? Like, you let that girl stay in school after she kicked the snot out of another student. She's a danger to students.
So the other piece of this, and we talked about this a bit yesterday with a school resource officer out of Geneva who called in. So there's a school resource officer in Lyons Township, and according to somebody close to the whole situation and to the victim's family, the school resource officer wasn't told that the girl, the victim, had talked to the assistant principal and said she was afraid because of rumors that this Heaven Washington was going to attack her. She was supposed to get some sort of escort from class to class, which is problematic in and of itself. And that escort didn't show up, and then Heaven Washington and her friends pounced. And the officer said to the victim, "Why didn't you tell me?" So she went to the assistant principal. The assistant principal, whose office is right next to the school resource officer, didn't bother to tell the school resource officer about this. And the question is, what is the relationship between the Western Springs Police Department and Lyons Township High School? How is the school resource officer's presence there? How is that received by the administrators and teachers? Because as we heard from the officer who called in from Geneva yesterday, you know, it really varies from school district to school district. In some school districts, there's very good collaboration, people on the same page. In others, they are more antagonistic toward the police. Remember, you're talking about mainly leftist administrators and leftist teachers that are members of leftist teachers unions. And so there's antagonism. There isn't cooperation. There is the let's leave it a school matter. Don't report to the police. Don't report anything to the police.
And there was a video, and that is why she's been charged.
And so it matters district by district. I don't know that that's the case. I don't know that it's because there's a video she's been charged, or because black and white and it raised the profile and people started asking questions that she's charged. I'm not suggesting that Western Springs PD wouldn't have brought charges, but I'd like to understand the relationship, because that's important to determine whether or not this is going to be the culture at Lyons Township High School. It seems to me, if I was a parent of a kid at LTHS or any school, I'd want to know, what exactly is the relationship between the school and the police? If there have been any violence issues in the school, certainly. Jim, St. Joe, Michigan.
Yes, good morning. Enjoy your show all the time. I think it was a tragic thing. And, you know, the sad thing too, Dan and Amy, is these kids that just stand around and film this. And where were some other young people to step in? When I was in high school, our high school was the regional special education school. And I remember one time a couple of us went into one of the restrooms down by the gym, and a couple of guys were picking on one of those students. And I tell you what, I don't think he ever picked on anybody in school anymore, because after he got his head dunked in the toilet a few times, punched in the nose, I think he gave up on it. And that's just tragic that these kids just stand around, and even on the street, people just stand around and watch somebody get beat up. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Jim. That's very true.
And her family, though, has a history of like thinking that they're above the law, because her grandmother went to LT, and she spoke a few months ago at a school board meeting and said, you know, we're going to, because her daughter, Heaven, had another incident where she smacked a guy, and they're like, no, we're not accepting a suspension.
Where she smacked a guy?
Yeah, because he, this is, you want to hear it? It's pretty interesting.
They were going on a walk with, if there was an active shooter at the school. So they walked around and told them where a safe place was.
It was a drill.
When she was doing that, she got hit on the butt several times by a guy. She told him to stop. He didn't stop. He did it again, and she punched him. They wanted her to have a suspension, but she wasn't going to have one. She went and told herself what happened.
Oh, really?
But she was supposed to get a detention. She didn't want it, and I didn't either.
Too bad.
Because that, you know, that was an assault. And I should have reported it to the Western Springs police, but I didn't.
Well, I don't know. I don't know the particulars there. If she didn't get a suspension, if he hit her and she hit him back, I mean, that's a different story. I don't know. I don't have anything in for this Heaven Washington. I mean, both her and her grandma are saying things that are not true, are saying things that certainly run afoul of things they've said previously. I mean, her grandma's talking. She talks about how racist LT is. Grandma went there, talks about how racist LT is. We read you her excerpt from her yearbook at LT from 19, I think it was 7. I don't remember. Whenever she went to high school, back 40 years ago, something like that. And it was, you know, how much she enjoyed her time at Lyons Township High School. And now fast forward 40 years and it's all racial politics all the time with Grandma Washington and Heaven Washington, who started the change.org petition, which you mentioned about LTHS is racist, and they're there with the anti-masking, or they're criticizing mask policy because they're pro mask, and you know, they're just activists.
Right.
She's an activist, and the grandma's so I
know the reason why
I
play that is because I don't like her attitude. Like, she got a suspension, but we're not going to take that, and she's not accepting that.
Well, yeah, but you have to, the context is important. If it's true that somebody hit her and then she hit him back, yes, you know, guy shouldn't be slapping her on the ass either. So I don't know. I don't know what the truth of that situation is, but there is something in the way that they are characterizing the environment. And of course, the actual adults, alleged adults in charge of the school, they endorse the approach that Heaven Washington and her grandma take. You know how I know that? Because they have a $150,000 a year die coordinator. So when you give license to the sort of identity politics justifies anything, if it's in furtherance of identity politics, then you're going to have incidents like this, and you're going to feel, and you're going to have kids who feel entitled to, right, you know, take the law into their own hands, as it were, or pound on somebody that they think slighted them. Barb Frankfurt, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. Honored to talk to you. And it's about that $150,000 racial equity job that I was calling about, because I'm wondering if you take it to its logical conclusion, she probably went home and said, "What a great day."
Okay. Thanks for the call, Barb. Tony Steger.
Yeah, I wonder how quick they'd arrest the white girl if the black girl went to beat her up and the white girl beat the crap out of her. I wonder how fast the police department would go in there and charge her as for a racial crime.
Well, thanks, Tony. Lewis, Southside.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Something ain't right with this. My question is, where are the lawsuits at? Why haven't the parents sued the Board of Education and the police department and the little girl's family? Because if she was injured, you know, anytime you're injured and they take you to like a hospital or something, they have to fill out a report on your injuries and where you got the injuries from and all that, you know. And so
I suspect
they'll be pending litigation.
Yeah, I suspect they were waiting for the police investigation. They have that in their back pocket when they file a civil suit against the school.
But
that's what's going to happen.
That's what I'm looking for, is for the lawsuits to stop all this. You know, it'll stop all that when you start suing them, just like they did. What was that in Virginia?
Yeah.
You know, when they sued them, you know, that's when that came about. And so this is a country of laws. Put the law on them.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. I agree. But, you know, it's interesting, too, about lawsuits. School districts use the threat of litigation to not do the right thing. Think about all of the school board members who gave you the threat of litigation. So we're imposing the mask mandate over the last 2 years, and we're sustaining the mask mandate. Threat of litigation. But when it comes to making the school environment toxic with identitarian politics, they're not so worried about litigation. That's what we have that's what we have legal counsel on retainer for. They're not worried about the implications of their ideology as it's implemented. No worries about litigation there in terms of inhibiting anything they do. But when it's to do the right thing, when it's to include parents, when it's to hold students accountable, then we hear a threat of litigation. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This coming to us from Evesham, New Jersey, Burlington County.
You teased this story yesterday, didn't we?
Uh-huh. Now we're getting to it.
Okay.
Imagine your 12-year-old daughter, who still plays with stuffed animals, comes home crying because while she was trying to wash her hands in the school bathroom, another female student comes into the bathroom, takes her by the neck, and pushes her up against the wall. Then when your daughter struggles to get free, the girl pins her hands down and presses her body up against your daughter's body, breathing heavily with her hot breath in your kid's face. Your daughter tells you that another student walked in, and that's when the assault stopped. She leaves the bathroom, goes back to the classroom, and hears that same girl tell the other kids freely that she was trying to rape your daughter in the bathroom. A few days later, in the hallway, that same girl kept trying to grab her neck while breathing in her ear and puts her hands under her skirt and up your daughter's back while your kid frantically tries to get away. The girl whispers, quote, "It's not like I can actually rape you in front of everyone here," unquote. With fear and tears in your daughter's eyes, she refuses to go back to school, sobbing, "How can a girl do that to another girl, Mom?" And what is the school doing about it? It seems to me, from hearing from parents, which you're about to hear, that they're doing about the same thing initially that Loudoun County did in the Smith family case, where two girls were sexually assaulted by a dude pretending to be a girl in the bathrooms of Loudoun County schools. The report from Evesham, The complication, the assailant is classified as a special victim class of student. She is a girl identifying as a non-binary with pronouns he, they, she, them. There happens to be 50 kids, 50, in just one wing of this school, changing their name to another gender.
Oh,
they are
on.
All a protected class of student that gets special privileges. The author recounting the story says this is happening all over in New Jersey, and schools are hiding and avoiding these types of situations to avoid conflict. They're also hiding the uptick of violence in these schools.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And so, once this got around to the parents shut up and forced the most recent Evesham school board meeting, talking not just about this incident, but about the culture in the school, about the curriculum as it informs the culture. Here's one mom.
You need to investigate what happened. You cannot have 50 children changing their names to a different gender in just one wing and tell me that things are okay here and that everybody's safe. Children of the same gender threatening to rape other students in bathrooms and bragging about it and going on TikTok and saying, I'll be right back in school. It's not okay. Your mission statement's off. Have a great night. Thank you.
Another mom on the alleged,
wouldn't have been that nice.
Alleged sexual assault.
I understand that there was a sexual assault that occurred in school a few weeks ago. I also understand from the family of the victim that there has been zero support offered from anyone in the district. And that the district has completely failed to protect her after the incident was reported. As a member of the Child Advocate Coalition, I call upon the superintendent and Principal Romanelli to either step down or invite an independent organization to conduct an investigation into the district's handling of this incident and any further incidents. Clearly, there has been an immense failure, and many citizens no longer feel safe sending their children here. Everyone involved should be ashamed of themselves. We seriously need to address and look into the sexual nature of the curriculum. I truly believe that this is leading many, that this is leading to many more disturbing incidents. We want to know and believe that our children are safe when we send them to schools and cared for. Sadly, many parents no longer feel this way with this district, and that's truly upsetting. Every district needs to be completely transparent with parents. Email all curriculum, give all parents an opt-out option, and be transparent. That's what we're asking for with every incident. Every parent in here should have been well aware of what has taken place here. And I don't think many know that. And it's very upsetting to many.
Which side of that divide is your kid's school district on? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, DA, turnkey.pro text line. I mean, there was a strong contingent of parents that showed up to address the school board in no uncertain terms, and this alleged sexual assault was obviously the trigger. Oh, by the way, dads too.
I'm appalled by the way that these meetings are run. You are nasty to the public who has a very, very valid reason to be upset. And it is your job to maintain your composure, to not roll your eyes, and to not certainly walk out. At the end of the day, no matter how much you may not agree with the public, you work for the public. And it is your duty to listen to them without interruption, without having your lawyer tell them to sit down, because that is your job.
That can't be said enough at government meetings, putting government officials in their place and, you know, demanding the respect that your underwriting of that government enterprise deserves. Another mom.
That who, dad was good, by the way.
Very he good. Really I got another effective. Dad who's even more entertaining. One mom too. Again, these are, you know, the interesting thing about this, these are very reasonable people. And I would think in the context, very measured. you can, you know, hear them in their own words. They're not ideological. Many of them probably, this was their first board meeting. They were galvanized by this alleged sexual assault and then the more information about the curriculum that started to circulate. But that's how these districts are going to be turned over to people that are rational and commonsensical rather than ideological. Listen to this mom, too. This mom had a question. Questions for the board. She read from the 5th and 8th grade sex education curricula at the school. And listen to, you know, what the top lines are of that curricula.
Okay, all right. So my questions are regarding the new curriculum for grade 5 and grade 8. For grade 5, the standard states that puberty is a time of physical, social, and emotional changes. And the performance expectation states, explain common human sexual development and the role of hormones. For example, romantic and sexual feelings, masturbation, mood swings, timing of pubertal onset. And then for the grade 8, hold on a second. Okay, here we are. There are factors that contribute to making healthy decisions about sex. The performance expectation states define vaginal, oral, and anal sex. So my question is, based on the state memo, how is Evesham going to interpret this? Because I do know that there is flexibility.
The response from some functionary was, you know, we'll talk offline privately. No, I mean,
let's do it in public. Come on.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it. That's why I was prepared. No, please. I'll cede my time.
Is this uncomfortable for you? Because it might be even more uncomfortable for our children.
Right.
That's the case.
I mean, some of the topic areas she ticked off for the 5th and 8th graders may raise some flags.
Yeah, it might.
Among some of the parents. I hope so. I have no idea. One of the other dads who spoke, this guy I really like, in part just because of how he starts his comments. Listen.
Ms. Eric Simpkin, I'm from Voorhees. I did mention already that my address is really none of your business. I'd like to talk about policy 9140. I'm not sure if anyone has read any of the policies, but that's about citizen advisory committees. This isn't a question and answer forum. I think that the citizens here need a question and answer forum. They're looking for answers. A 3-minute one-way speech, whatever you want to call it, a comment, is not a conversation. Mm. It's not communicating. It's a one-way communication. Every relationship requires good communication to be successful, and this communication process is a failure. I'm also suggesting the public become involved with the board and the schools by the schools adopting, according to policy 9140, citizen advisory committees for curriculum development, for policy review and enforcement, and vendor vetting. Those three things seem to be causing a whole lot of problems, and the consequences are things that we're going to see as a community very similar to the assault that occurred. That assault is the direct result of policy and curriculum, and it needs to change, and the parents and the community need to be heard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent summation, including on the format of these meetings. This, you know, you get up there and you speak for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and nobody has to answer any questions or respond to any comments because it's our policy. We have this policy, so we don't have to use our brains. We've got these policies and procedures. Well, we don't want things to become protracted and we don't want. We're adults. What's this protracted stuff? 3 minutes. If I have questions like that mom who had the questions about curriculum, then you answer them in a public forum so you're on the record and everybody can hear it and you're held accountable for what you say in a public forum rather than these siloed conversations with individual parents that you have so you can play the he said, she said game.
They work for us.
And, you know, so I really appreciate what those fathers, what everybody had to say. But again, this is the backdrop against an alleged sexual assault. If you think it's not happening at your school district, I would challenge that. You may want to look a little deeper, because I think it's much more prevalent than people want to admit. A Florida mom, January Littlejohn is her name. She was one of the parents who really led the revolt against the schools and school boards in Florida that materialized into the Florida parenting parental rights law that DeSantis signed into law.
Oh, good.
And it's because this happened to her daughter at school.
It's not a final opinion. It's a draft opinion.
My daughter, at the height of the pandemic, expressed confusion over her sex. And this was after three other friends in her peer group also had suddenly started identifying as transgender. Unfortunately, this is becoming a common occurrence among teen girls especially. And once school started, about 3 weeks into school, my daughter got into the car and said, "Mom, we had a meeting and they asked me which restroom I wanted to use." So after many weeks of going back and forth with the district, because initially when I asked what happened at the meeting, they told me they cannot tell me anything about the meeting because my daughter was now protected by a non-discrimination law. But eventually we did see the transgender support plan, which was a 6-page document that they completed with my daughter that was 13 at the time, behind closed doors, where they asked her questions that would have absolutely impacted her safety, such as which restroom she preferred to use and which sex she preferred to room with on overnight field trips. Well, I was outraged, and frankly, all parents should be outraged. And what we have found, Carly, is that this is happening all over the nation. This same protocol is in place in many, many schools across districts everywhere. And even the guides being used to dictate these transgender support plans that cut parents out even have the same language. So this is a very systematic way that parents are being excluded from important decisions occurring with their children. And further, social transition is a medical intervention that schools are grossly unqualified to be taking these steps without parental involvement.
That's well said. I mean, so they groom and then they isolate. Isolate you from parents, isolate your kid from law enforcement. You're hearing the same thing from the Florida mom as you're hearing from those parents in Evesham, New Jersey. They groom, special designation. You know, I can't share, I can't inform because protected by non-discrimination law. And so then parents are cut out of their children's life.
And the decision-making process. And then the teachers, you know, tell the kids, you know, if you want to change your name, now tell your parents you're going to change your name. And, you know, I know a girl who changed her name. My parents went along with the court to change her name to a boy's name.
Jeff, Cal City.
And now she wants it back.
Hi. Good morning, Dan and Amy. Excellent show as always. Information. It seems that these people have skin in the game. These school board members don't have any children, or they have children that have since grown up and completely out of college. And these crazy teachers that are promoting these insane agendas and acting insane in the classroom don't have children. I mean, I know it's crazy, but I would love to see school board. You'd only elect school board members that actually have kids going to school in the district. And then let's see how they react.
Thanks, Jeff.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was outside the Supreme Court building late last night in D.C. Am I always with the drums, these people? Always with the drums.
Hastily made signs, dude.
Yeah, hastily made, right. Yeah, They're like strike squads. This was after Politico published a alleged draft opinion from February of the Supreme Court's, previewing what the Supreme Court's holding was going to be in the Dobbs case out of Mississippi. And the preview is Alito and four of his colleagues have voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. This was leaked by someone in the inner sanctum, obviously, and there's a lot of supposition that it may have been one of Justice Sotomayor's, one of her clerks. The implication of this leak, which is really, I mean, there are, you know, leaks and there's suppositions. There's always cloak and dagger mystery and speculation around high profile cases the Supreme Court has undertaken. But this is of a completely different kind. And it really now calls into question the legitimacy of the court, so much so that Jeffrey Toobin was able to stop pleasuring himself for 5 seconds to offer a cogent cogent comment on the topic.
There has never been a leak anything like this. There's never been a leak of a vote, much less an actual opinion, much less in a case of this significance. It's really going to be an interesting question, putting aside so much about this, what this means for the institution of the Supreme Court, you know, what it means for the respect that the justices and the court's decisions are held. The idea that a decision of this magnitude could leak is really a shattering experience for the justices and the court. And I really don't know how or if the institution's going to recover.
Big statements. Oh, these institutions are always melting down because everything is apocalyptic with the left, but I don't disagree with the underlying point that Toobin is making.
Ari Fleischer and Mike Huckabee are saying that it's an insurrection against the Supreme Court.
Rachel Maddow and her doppelganger Chris Hayes, this is how they handled it in real time as the news broke that Politico had published this draft opinion, had obtained and published this draft opinion. Take a listen, because this is a good indication of what you're going to hear from the left for the next forever, actually, but in particular over the next several weeks into the midterms.
It was not surprising for people to follow the court. This was not the outcome that people thought was not going to happen. People to listen to oral arguments. The fact that they specifically asked to overturn Roe, which they didn't have to do. The chomping at the bit that happened at oral arguments from the justices who clearly wanted to go right for the apple. None of that surprising, but to have this draft opinion there on the internet is shocking.
It is shocking, as you said, and as we started discussing here, it's shocking both in substance, and it is also shocking in terms of what it means about the court and what it means about the stakes here that someone was willing to do this. It is just a remarkable thing. Chris, thank you for handling this as legitimately breaking, sort of overwhelming breaking news.
Well, I mean, you know, they leaked it because they want to change the outcome.
Well, the Maddow or Hayes, I don't know, they look the same, they sound the same as far as I'm concerned. They say the same things. But the substance is what she's focused on. And when she says what it means for the court, she's talking about the substance of the opinion, not the leak. Because the left is otherwise hailing whoever leaked this as brave, right, as taking heroic action. This was a Brian Fallon, who's a for Clinton-era Department of Justista and also worked for the Dem Socialist Senate senators as well. So that's the posture. So this is coming from the clerk of a judge who will be in the dissent. It would seem that's most logical for the purpose of trying to, I guess, accomplish through public opinion what they couldn't accomplish through oral arguments. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Mary Fiorito. She is a pro-life attorney. She's also a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So your reaction to the publication, first and foremost, the publication of this draft opinion.
Yeah, that's that to me was the most shocking part of all of this. I mean, if for anybody who watched the oral arguments back on December 1st, the outcome of this case is not a surprise, and I do believe that it's going to be the outcome, what was leaked last night, but the leak itself, what a massive betrayal of trust.
to see something like this. Again, not just, you know, a suggestion of how the court was going to rule or even who might be on which side, but to leak the entire draft opinion. If whoever did this is found out, and as you noted, there seems to be a lot of speculation that it's one of the clerks for Justice Sotomayor, that person's going to get disbarred. I mean, that's how serious
should be.
A breach this is. Absolutely. I can't even imagine the conversations at the court this morning. And frankly, I would not be surprised if even the Chief Justice was so angered by what happened that he flips to the other side and it does become a 6-3 decision. So just an incredibly egregious betrayal of whoever that clerk's justice is, and then to all the other justices and clerks. This just does not happen at the Supreme Court.
No, but also timing's everything. I mean, there's primary elections today in Indiana and Ohio. So how do you think that played into this?
Well, I don't know if it was so much targeted to primary elections, but certainly it's going to be targeted to the midterms. I have no doubt that whoever did this wanted to stir up public sentiment, wanted to create a wave of fear to get Democrats to the polls because, you know, as you mentioned on your show every morning, this is going to be a red bloodbath at the midterms, and they're trying to stem that tide. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's and unfortunately, too, what you have to realize is that so many people don't even understand Roe, much less what overturning Roe would do. So the left always plays on this lack of knowledge and on fear and confusion to get people to vote for something, you know, that has no basis in fact.
Before we get to the substance of the Dobbs case and the potential that Roe is overturned, Andy McCarthy tweeted out that, you know, in order to preserve any sort of integrity here, to preserve the court's integrity, he suggested that the Supreme Court should fast track this opinion. More likely it would have been towards the end of the term, at the end of June. But now, based on this leak, they should get this out sooner rather than later. Do you agree?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I do. Absolutely. In fact, my colleague Ed Whalen, who's a former Supreme Court clerk himself, also tweeted that out last night, that, you know, the dissenting justices can finish up their dissents and publish them later. But now that this has been leaked, the court should get this published as quickly as possible.
So, Mary, what does it mean if Roe v. Wade is overturned?
So if Roe is overturned, essentially all of the abortion laws in the country go back to the individual states. Now, you know, we know here in Illinois, our state General Assembly has already acted preemptively. So abortion is legal in Illinois and by and large taxpayer funded right up until the moment of birth. Our freestanding clinics here, you can just Google this, it's very easy to find, do elective abortions. So that means healthy mom and healthy baby right up to 24 weeks, 6 months of pregnancy. And hospitals and other clinics that can do the more dangerous late-term abortions, it can do them legally right up until the moment of birth. This is how extreme Illinois is. And of course, starting June 1st, as we've discussed on the show previously, minor girls, 12, 13, 14-year-old girls can get abortions, and the abortion clinics now do not have to notify parents. And that is a direct result of Governor Pritzker's signing the repeal of the parental notice bill. And I do hope your listeners remember that when they go to the polls.
Mm-hmm. And reaction from Democrat socialists at the federal level is the call to pass a right to abortion in legislative form.
Right.
What, you know, so that's unlikely to occur. But let's say that they were able to get something like that to Joe Biden's desk. If how would any sort of legislation on that order, how would it be impacted if the court overturned Roe?
Well, what the court is essentially saying is this belongs to the legislative process. It belongs to the people, this particular decision. And the Democrats, in fact, had a bill not long ago in the House that passed, like the Women's Health Protection Act or something like that, which would have codified Roe and was a really extreme bill, even, you know, making legal allowances for things like sex selection abortions, you know, which are sadly perfectly legal in the United States. Most of those are done on baby girls. But, Bernie Sanders tweeted out last night, we need to codify Roe at the federal level. That could potentially happen. I don't think it's going to, and I don't think it's going to particularly. They don't have quite the majorities that they need, and I think that they don't have the will of the American people. So when you put abortion, the question itself, to the American people,
people will like generally say, oh yeah, I support Roe versus Wade. But then when you ask them specific questions about times and pregnancies, about reasons, the vast majority of Americans say first trimester only. And then even within that group, they say only for very serious reasons. So American people do not believe what Roe held, and they certainly want it to be moderated in some way. We're one of only seven countries in the world, in fact, that has legal abortion up until the moment of birth. So this is a law that's absolutely not reflective of the will of American people. It's not who we are as Americans. We care for vulnerable people. We especially protect the weak and the voiceless. And this has been a long time coming. I'm glad to see it. I just don't think they would, Dan, you could probably speak to this better than I could, that at a federal level, senators and representatives would take on such a volatile issue, and because I think it would make them vulnerable politically.
No, I think you're right, but I think it's also important to note that this would overturning Roe or turns to the states, and different legislatures and governors do different things in different states, as we've seen playing out, for years, and including a real press recently. But it doesn't prevent Congress from acting. So when you talk about, think about what Pritzker did in terms of your vote here come November. Also, remember that, Congress isn't barred from participating in this either per a return to the states. So who controls Congress matters on this issue, too.
Right. You're absolutely right. And I think it's also important to keep in mind the vast amounts of money that the abortion lobbying groups have, that they will be directing to these federal races if they see, for example, a pro-life Democrat like Chris Butler in the Illinois First possibly having a chance. They might really target that district now with a lot of abortion money, and they have campaign workers, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you are going to see an effort to get more completely committed pro-abortion senators and Democratic congressmen elected.
And for those, something else that we were talking about a bit earlier, too, is that one of the things that this will do is it will flesh out a bunch more phony pro-life Republicans who are sort of the summer soldier and sunshine patriot version of a pro-life Republican. It's good for a mail piece come election time, but I don't really want to do anything about it. And I certainly don't want to talk about it, and I don't want to have to make an argument on behalf of it. So as these fights play out, at least in some of the states where it's not sort of settled and the political balance of power isn't settled, you're going to have people that are compelled to stand up and pick a side and be able to make a case and defend a case. And so that's a good thing, too.
It is. I mean, and the Republican Party has seen enough of Bruce Rauners and Mark Kirks and, other Republicans who are really Republicans in name only in many aspects. And I do hope it'll kind of, like you say, it'll flesh this stuff out, and people will be able to see what their representatives really stand for. Can they even speak about the issue articulately? I mean, that's a hope I have. I hope they will really study this. Many of them are lawyers, that they'll really study this so they'll be able to articulate the argument against it, which is a substantive one.
She is Mary Fiorito, pro-life attorney, fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mary, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mary. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House law for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It's time for it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. And we brought this video to you several weeks back, these organizations that are out there pitching their propaganda in the direction of identitarian politics, racialization, sexualization of young kids. And I don't think people, I think some people don't believe it's real until it visits their school district. Well, this organization called AMAZE has visited a school district in Wilmette, Avoca School District 37, Neuchur Township, 700 kids. And among the educational cartoon videos that are provided to the kids by AMAZE includes an answer to the question, well, a sexual version of the question, how many licks does a kid take to get to the center of a Tootsie Lollipop?
Yes, come on, yes, oh yes, aha!
What are you doing there? You've had enough for one day. You'll go blind.
Young Jeffrey Toobin.
I'm coming!
How many times is too many to masturbate in one day?
What?
Hashtag AskAmaze! There's no limit on the number of times a person can masturbate each day. It's normal to have lots of sexual feelings and desires when going through puberty. And while some people want to do it all day long, others may not want to. Do it as much as you want. But if it's interfering with your schoolwork or keeping you from friends and family, then maybe it's time to slow down.
Ah! What are you doing?
Hey, give me some privacy.
Not here.
Only masturbate where you're sure to have some privacy.
Find out more about masturbation right here on AMAZE.
Sure. Or you can watch Judge Reinhold in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So AMAZE, as I understand it, the video you heard there, not only is it at that grade school district on the North Shore, it's also got the stamp of approval from the Illinois State Board of Education.
That's right. You know, AMAZE is tied to another group, and that other group is part of ISBE's curriculum. You know, they recommend curriculum on sex ed. So they're in the door, let's say, and we know that it's being used by Lurie, the hospital group, to teach kids. You know, in this case, Avoca, the school district, outsources that fifth grade curriculum to Lurie. So, you know, Lurie is, quote, you know, trusted, right? They're going to do the right things. And I'm sure, I don't know how many school districts they teach to, but it's in the system. We know it's in other schools as well. So it's just a matter of, you know, digging out who else is using it.
And are we sure they're not being shown, this isn't being shown to other students other than fifth graders?
Well, we don't know. Now, look, you know, the ones that we know were shown to fifth graders at Avoca were one on body odor, one on the male anatomy, one on the female anatomy. They weren't shown this one, I don't think. The problem is that when – not yet. And the problem with this is, you know, this is the internet age, right? So when Lurie vets or effectively, you know – endorses a group like AMAZE and their videos, you know, once a kid's in that site, I mean, you should see they've got 177 videos. Some of them are not as objectionable. Others are very objectionable. The one we just played was one. The other one we pointed out was the one on, is it okay to watch porn or is it wrong to watch porn? And they say, absolutely not. It's okay to watch porn. You know, when it goes there, it's like, you know, anything goes after that. Right. Mm.
And yeah, we also have, we were talking about this a bit earlier in the show, Evesham, New Jersey, the curriculum there, and the designating students who are identifying as trans as like a special victim class and then isolating them from their parents, not informing their parents what's going on, what actions the school is taking and so forth. Well, this is also the Illinois State Board of Education guidance. So, again, for parents, families who don't think this is or could happen at your school district in Illinois, the guidance from Illinois State Board of Education is that you do not inform parents about the transitioning of your kid.
This is, I think, one of the scariest parts of all this. You know, they got a video on that. And, you know, anybody who doesn't understand what's happening in the whole movement there should read Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier. I know she's been on your show. Yeah, you've got kids who are wanting to transition, thinking about transitioning, changing their pronouns, and many parents can't find out, won't find out because the school district won't tell them. And as a matter of fact, the school district is kept from, or you know, it's they're protecting the children, they say, and they won't tell the parents. And so things are going on, you know, just like this educational videos, if you want to call them that, they're going on and parents have no clue. And that's, I think, the scary part of all this is parents have no clue. It's happening and they don't know.
And if it wasn't for wire points, would they not know ever?
Well, yeah,
unless their kids came home and told them.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I mean, this is a case where, you know, and here's the interesting thing about Avoca. A parent let Nutria Neighbors know that the video was being shown. And so we FOIA'd Avoca for it. And the first response back from Avoca was, no, we're not doing this. We don't. And because they said they didn't have any documents to share with us. Well, we said, well, we didn't ask you if you have documents. We asked you if you were showing these videos. Well, only after that did we come and get a FOIA back. And we included that in our piece this morning in wirepoints.org. We included it there. They said, oh, we didn't understand what you were asking for. You weren't clear last time. So, you know, just even trying to find out these things is hard enough as it is.
On another topic, Matt Rosenberg, who contributes to Wire Points there, Milt Rosenberg's son. We've had him on the program before. He's got an interesting piece about Rockford. You know, we focus on talk about violent crime. We focus on Chicago, understandably. But we also are quick to mention you have the same problems going on a smaller scale in some of these mid-sized communities around the state, including the community Matt Rosenberg writes about, which is Rockford, which is the fifth largest city in the state, about 150,000 people. Violent crime up 26% 2021 over 2019. Aggravated assaults up 41%. Murders up 33%. Car thefts up 12%. So in these mid-sized cities, the bigger ones are basically Democrat strongholds too around the state. And we see a lot of the same problems in these mid-sized urban areas.
Yeah, you know, Matt, yeah, and at Wire Points, we've been tracking just Chicago and just watching those numbers continue to go up. You know, 2021 was a record over the last 25 years in many of the crimes compared to pre-COVID, right? Before George Floyd, before all the COVID mess, 2021 was bad. And 2022 has been worse in many cases,
yeah,
and a lot of stuff. And so we decided, well, let's look around, right? Because we know the same bad laws that exist in Illinois exist in our other cities, maybe not as bad, but it's fascinating to see that a place like Rockford has seen really bad numbers through 2021 compared to the pre-COVID time.
Well,
and it's getting worse this year. It's
yeah.
getting worse this year. So it's like, you know, COVID is supposed to be over. Things are supposed to get back to normal, and they're not.
Well, he notes in his piece, too, January and February of 2022, motor vehicle thefts up 94%, shots fired up 48%. Report violent crime incidents reported up 16%, aggravated assaults up 14%. So this is January and February as compared to last year, to your point about coming out of the pandemic. But what you wrought during the pandemic at the local level, as well as the state level with the anti-police, anti-law enforcement legislation Pritzker signed, that and anti-prosecution legislation, including the elimination or phasing out of no cash bail, that's having these impacts.
Oh, yeah. And you know what was funny? Yeah, this is kind of sad. We're wondering whether we said Rockford violent crime way up in 2022. And we said, can we say that it's only up 16%? And we said, you know, normally that would be a massive increase, right? So it's getting really confusing because crime is up so much that 16% sounds small these days. And that's what's scary about all these numbers.
And nobody has a solution. You know, CTA, three people were stabbed within 24 hours and you know, they put these unarmed security guards on there. That's not working. Cook County Sheriff's Department is a new, you know, field office in Dan's neighborhood in River North with 100 officers or deputies, and nothing's changing. Nothing is moving the needle. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, you know, Amy, I go back to 2019 was an interesting year because crime was way down overall. And you can't help but think that the Trump economy and the lowest unemployment rate ever for blacks, for Hispanics, for women, for everybody, that had people doing other things like maybe working and looking for jobs because it was a great environment. Since then, we've turned that upside down, right? And you can't help but think that that's one. So, you know, the long term support and the long term solutions are, you know, get people jobs and get the economy to grow and thrive. But in the short term, until we get to that, until we solve the root causes, we're going to continue to talk about those things with Matt over the next, you know, over the next year. But we got to stop what's happening now, and that's only going to be because we prosecute crime and we let the policemen do their job. We got to take the handcuffs off the policemen and put them on the criminals. So until we do that, these numbers are going to look just like they are now. I'm hoping that somehow they slow down, but hell, you'd think that they would have. But looking at year-to-date numbers in Chicago and Rockford, and soon we'll look at other cities, is that it continued, the negative trend continues.
Yeah, and as we learn from the Obama years, hope is not a strategy. Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks as always, Ted.
Hey, thanks. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, in our continuing series to bring you Republican candidates for governor. And this is the second or third go-around for some of them. Second go-around for our next guest, Jesse Sullivan, who's making his first run for office. He is a former DOD contractor. He's the founder of a venture capital investing firm, Alter Global, and, of course, a Republican candidate in the June 28th primary. And he's got a new spot up
that I absolutely have fallen in love with. You ready? But you kind of need to see it. But
I have seen it.
Oh, isn't it? It's life-changing.
My husband, Jesse Sullivan, knows business. So the lessons around here start early.
Okay, kiddos. Here's your allowance you earned this week. But this is Illinois, so there's a tax for pretty much everything.
These days, it's hard enough to stretch a dollar. As governor, Jesse will put money back in the hands of Illinois families by repealing Pritzker's gas tax, eliminating the grocery tax, and by vetoing any new tax increase.
Which means you get to keep more of your allowance.
Yeah! And his wife is stunningly gorgeous. The kids are adorable. It's just, you know, it's one of those feel-good campaign ads.
Yeah. For more on this.
Dan's really... Mushy well, on this one.
You know, I'm a tough audience for feel good campaigns.
Yeah,
I gotta tell
you. So, yes.
I gotta be honest. Jesse Sullivan joins us. Jesse, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So let's talk about you mentioned in the ad about the tax side. What about the price side? The price of everything, obviously, taxes go into that, like at the pump. But I'm thinking about something else in the news recently because of the Biden administration's latest student debt forgiveness gambit. You know, reminded me that University of Illinois has the third highest in-state tuition of all the Big Ten schools, behind only Michigan and Rutgers, and barely behind them. And I just wonder, you know, if we could get some gubernatorial leadership on making Illinois live up to its commitment as a state public land grant university to prioritize Illinois families and their kids and to make it more affordable to those same Illinois families and their kids.
Yeah, absolutely. The prices of everything have gone up because the Democrats say, oh, you can get free handouts. We all know nothing is free. We're all paying on the back end through inflation, ridiculously high prices, you know, at the grocery store and everywhere else. And then on top of it here in Illinois, you just get taxes on top of everything. And we have a huge spending problem in the state of Illinois. And our universities are great. We have some of the best universities around the entire world. And yeah, they're way too expensive for students to be able to attend them. And we need to keep and retain our talent here in Illinois. You know, like Mark Andreessen helped create the original version of the internet, you know, and went out to the Bay Area in San Francisco to build all of it. I want to make sure that as we're building, you know, the future industries, we do it right here in Illinois. And that's the background I bring to this, where I think it's really differentiated is I've been doing work on helping entrepreneurs create new business industries. And we need that here in Illinois. You know, I was doing it around the world, and I realized we need to do that right here in Illinois.
Well, okay, yeah, provide some detail on that. Give us an example of some of the work that you've done in that space of helping entrepreneurs develop businesses, maybe, you know, one particular vignette.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I was over in Afghanistan, and how I got into this whole space is I was over in Afghanistan, and this militia commander said, "You see these young men, they have no jobs or opportunity. If you want to have peace over here, then we need to help create jobs, grow the economy." So went back to business school, launched Alter, which, you know, went back over to Pakistan, actually, where two guys with a pitch deck, an idea, you know, a sketch on a napkin. And we have now helped grow that into what's going to be Pakistan's first billion-dollar tech company. And it's creating brain gain. All this talent is coming back. And it really is helping small business owners to be able to get access to goods over their smartphones and also get loans and lending for the first time on their smartphones. And so these are the types of industries we've been backing. And as I was doing that work, it's like, man, we need to do that right here at home and create these jobs and future industries here in Illinois.
Wanted to get your reaction following the unprecedented leak last night of the landmark Supreme Court decision that could ultimately overturn Roe v. Wade.
Isn't that beautiful? It makes me so incredibly happy. I have to tell you, when I read it last night, I had this great joy come over me. Our family actually went down on our knees and we said a prayer as a family in gratitude to God. And then we said the Pledge of Allegiance together as a family. And I have to tell you, the flag looked even better, you know, shines even brighter, because it's like, man, you know, we are actually going to, you know, recognize, you know, these young lives that are going to be saved. And so, you know, for me, it was just a beautiful thing. Now the battle becomes here in Illinois. It's seriously a matter of life and death of who the next governor is going to be. And J.B. Pritzker wants to make us the most pro-abortion state in the entire nation. And that means we're going to have late-term partial birth abortions, taxpayer-funded with no parental notification, people flooding into the state of Illinois, and our taxpayers paying for it for these young children with their parents not even being notified. Like, it is lives on the line, and I want to be a governor who's going to push back against that, get back to our Midwestern values, and you know, live up to this pro-life cause and mission that I feel like is a deep part of my faith.
Well, so, I mean, I think it's sort of implicit in your answer, but let me get it explicitly said with this question. So even if you were to replace Pritzker, even if the General Assembly is still controlled by Democrat Socialists, you're saying that you're going to be a pro-life, you would be a pro-life leader as governor. You're going to use the bully pulpit to make the case for what is feasible, like a return to, you know, parental notification, things that are supported by three quarters of even Illinois families. Is that a fair statement to describe you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look at young children, 13, 14 year olds, you know, they're going to come across the border with, they don't even have to notify their parents. And then our taxpayers are going to be paying for the abortions around the entire Midwest. And this could be late term partial birth, you know, and so my, you know, a lot of people say, hey, you don't have a voting record. You know, how can we trust you? We had Bruce Rauner come in. He betrayed us on and betrayed me on this most important value. Well, I don't have a voting record. I'm a political outsider. I have a life record. And so some of my earliest memories, I can remember actually going with my mom to stand outside of a Planned Parenthood clinic in Springfield with this sign. I drove 16 hours during college out to the March for Life, and my wife and I decided to do foster care for, you know, a young teen mom and our other daughter. And we did it not because we didn't have enough kids in the home, but because we want to live these pro-life values. And so in me, you will have a champion for these values.
I think we addressed this a little bit the last time you were on, but it's become more pronounced since, you know, because Ken Griffin poured $20 million into Richard Irvin's campaign. And that is Richard Irvin characterizing you as some sort of Obama lover, Obama operative, turned Republican. How do you address that characterization that's being made?
Yeah, one is you just look at Richard Irvin himself, and he's got so much liberal stink on him that he decides he wants to try to spread it around to everybody else falsely. And just, you know, it's he lies through his teeth, and the campaign team he's built around him, it's just honesty, integrity doesn't matter. And what he's doing to Darren Bailey and I is just, you know, making up all sorts of false lies. And so I don't trust him any further than I can throw him, you know, same as J.B. Pritzker. You're just going to get more of the same corruption, pay to play politics. And so, you know, for me, when it comes to my background, like we were a sports family, not a political one. You know, my faith's always driven my life. The one area where the Democrats really lied that I had to figure out was around poverty, you know, that we talked about last time. Like, really, they said, we are the ones who care about people in need. And I had to learn, no, you don't. Handouts do not create, they create dependency. It's about job creation, growing the economy. That's why I've gone on to, you know, take on socialism and socialist countries with capitalism. And that's what I want to bring here in Illinois is just these conservative values. I'm a fiscal, social, constitutional conservative. And I believe all of our rights flow from God. Well, and we push back when government encroaches on those rights.
And I mean, just sort of some context, too. I mean, when Obama was first elected in 2008, what were you, 20 years old?
Yeah, I was in college. Yep.
So did you vote for Obama? Did you vote for Biden? Because I get text messages all the time telling me that you did.
No, here's the truth. I've not voted for a Democrat in a decade. And so I voted Republican in the last election. I will vote Republican in the next election. And I am a true conservative. And so it's just like Ronald Reagan or Donald Trump himself. Those who grow into their conservative values and beliefs, no one's going to convince them otherwise. No one's going to convince me otherwise. And I actually am a better advocate now to head into around Chicago and say, hey, disaffected Democrats and independents, they are lying to you. And don't believe the words coming out of their mouth that they are the compassionate party and that they are the ones, you know, I can speak Spanish. I'm heading into these communities saying, you are pro-life, you're pro-faith, you're pro-family, you're pro-small business. You belong with us on the conservative side. And no one's going to make that argument as well as me as a next generation conservative to bring people into the Republican Party.
So last time you were on the show, you talked about some unnamed parties that tried to threaten you out of the race, tried to bribe you out of the race, some version of that. And at that time, you weren't ready to tell us who that individual or individuals were. How about now?
Yeah, I mean, it's all the people running Richard Irvin's race. They're the ones who have been putting out the lies, misinformation. You know, I know you're on John Cass and you were talking about the combine yourself. You know, these same figures are the ones who have ruined, you know, Illinois politics. So Mike Z, I don't even know how to say his last name, but, you know, the whole crew of them, they've been around before. Everyone who's in Illinois politics knows this swamp. And so they are the same figures that they have this line for Irvin, you know, take it back. Well, what they're going to do is take it back to the Rahner days. If you want to take it back to the combine, you know, you have your option. And me, I'm a conservative outsider. And if you want something totally different, who doesn't owe anybody anything, you know, who's going to actually do things different, then I'd encourage all your listeners to take a look at me. You know, jessesullivan.com, our website, find someone who is actually not beholden to this whole establishment, you know, political class here in Illinois that's destroyed our homes.
And just for a little bit more color on that, what did the Richard Irvin operatives, what did they say to you back, you know, earlier in the campaign to try to get you out?
Oh, I mean, they, you know, it's there were multiple different occasions where we were interacting. But what I can tell you is they want total control when they do what they do. I am totally unwilling to give total control. You know, I was new stepping into this. I don't know, you know, the difference between a campaign manager, a general consultant, all the stuff, like, but I did know that I have a set of values and I am pro-life and I'm not going to waver on that just because it's politically convenient. And then whenever they say, oh, you know, hey, maybe you should run for a different office and we can help you with that. It's like, I'm sorry, but I am the best person to take on the state of Illinois and fix our home. I'm a fifth generation Illinoisan. I love this place. my background around the key areas that matter most around safety. And I wasn't a contractor over in Afghanistan. I was a DOD civilian employee that went over in uniform with a weapon out on combat patrols, setting up local police forces. And now we have local police here in Illinois that are have become, you know, demeaned, devalued. It's the reason we've got the largest number of sheriffs across the state that have backed me and endorsed our plan. And they know I'm the guy who will protect and serve. Also, we talked about the economy. I've created jobs around the world. I know how to do it right here in Illinois. I'm the best person to lead as governor. And so they tried their best to get me out of the race, but it's not going to happen.
What office did they want you to run for?
Oh, they mentioned a few different ones. You know, just other statewide, maybe Senate, all this. It's like, no, no interest. Right. I love my home. I want to fix our home. So, and I'm the best person to do that. And the other thing is, you know, what's nice is just like entrepreneurship is you don't get to tell me. I get to decide what my life is going to be, what values I hold in me. You will have a leader who is not beholden to this whole political class that has driven our state into the ground. I'm going to fight back against it. I am a fighter for these outsider conservative values in our home. That's what we need. We don't need someone who can manage the decline of Illinois. We're already the lowest in the entire country on almost every single measure. We need to be first. We need to start winning again. We need an innovator governor. We need a next generation conservative that can do that. And I'm not going to just do more of the same. And I think that's what you'll get with Richard Irvin.
And by the way, I met Jesse's girl. See what I did there? On Friday night, your wife was at the Illinois Right to Life dinner. She was very lovely. It was very nice to meet her as well.
Oh, well, thanks, Dan. Yeah, I appreciate it. My wife is, that's right. I say I owe no man anything. I don't, but I owe my wife everything. She's incredible. She's like a saint taking care of all these kids that we have and also being out there as an advocate for these issues, you know, like pro-life. And she's the director of religious education for our church, and I'm just so grateful for her support as we do this as a team.
He is Jesse Sullivan, former DOD civilian employee, founder of VC, venture capital investing firm, Alter Global, and, of course, Republican candidate for governor of Illinois, jessesullivan.com, for more information on his campaign and candidacy. Jesse, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy. I appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We mentioned it a bit earlier in the program. June 27th is the date for our annual golf outing at Mistwood Golf Club in Romeoville, which is a great track and a great complex, too.
It's a tough course.
It is tough.
It's a long slog, all right? You bring a lot of balls.
Yes, it's a long slog or schlog. I don't know what a schlog is.
You know what? I just make up words sometimes.
I'm well aware. What's it? 560theanswer.com/golf. 560theanswer.com/golf is how you sign up for your foursome today. So do so. And this year, our charitable partner and beneficiary of some of the proceeds that are raised is Lydia Home. And we've talked about Lydia Home before, but we're going to talk about it again.
Good.
Make sure it resonates. Chip Borkowski is the director of development with Lydia Home. And he joins us in studio this morning. Chip, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's start with just the broad overview of what Lydia Home does and what it's been doing for 100 years.
Yeah, over 100 years. It's been crazy. We provide truly hope and healing for 40 kids in our residential program and around 300 kids and families throughout Chicagoland. The kids who are at our 4300 West Irving Park location, they have had a lot of trauma. So we help them in counseling and school to get them ready to become, foster kids.
When you say trauma, you mean abuse?
Yes, yes.
So, and this can be physical abuse, sexual abuse, yeah. All of the above.
Yeah, all of the above. It's really, it's a horrible thing. You can't even think about it. It makes you angry and it makes you want to cry.
Yeah, we had a foster child for 6 months.
Yep, and I remember.
How do you prepare them with, you know, what kind of counseling do you do to prepare them to go into that home?
Well, it's really all
or
customized.
Like life facts or daily chores.
Right. We have professional counselors who know better than I do on how they are treated in the protocols. But it really all begins with they need to be able to trust someone. And they've earned the right to not trust adults. And so we just have to, you know, strip it down to the foundation and really start helping these kids know that not everybody is abusive and that there's a lot of love out there.
And so talk about the sort of the success of Lydia Home in terms of the, you know, the formula you use to get children ready for foster care, and then, you know, that you're the ability to track those outcomes and compare those to sort of, you know, other, well, compare those to, for say, for example, what the state does, what the foster care system does on its own,
right?
Because obviously there's a lot of
metrics out there that are again very scary.
Yeah.
So at Lydia we have kids anywhere from 6 to 17, and then they age out. And so once they do age out, the stats say that over 50% will become either addicted to drugs or become sex traffickers. And the metrics that we have tracked are much more optimistic than that. And so if we get the kids at six, that gives us a lot more opportunity to work with them, to provide them mentors, just to show them love. And, you know, we also work with the families, though, too, the parents. In a perfect world, the kids are better off in their own home as long as it's safe. And so it's just not working with the kids, it's working with the families. In a perfect world, it would be great if Americans would be more proactive in what it is to be a good family. And that's where it all starts, is it's decades and decades and generations of just poor parenting.
Brokenness.
For a lot of reasons. Yeah.
Well, what does it mean to be, you know, like pro family, to be a good family? Because I think every family in some way is dysfunctional.
Yeah.
I mean, you think every neighbor's downstairs, right? Yeah. Every, you know, they're fine, and then they're not. It's
right. Well, what was it? What makes a good family?
Yeah.
Well, I could tell you, I grew up in. And I think a very good family, was raised by a single mom, was always in contact with my dad. But what we always had was love. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had a lot of love to go around. And cousins, I come from the South Side, so we had a lot of cousins, right? And you know, family and friends. And, you know, we worked through it. And, you know, you try to break that cycle of, you know, divorce, you know, it doesn't always happen, but, you know, the perfect family is different for everyone. Faith-based, grew up in a Catholic home. And, so that was frowned on, getting divorced, but it, you know, both got remarried and it worked out, you know, so I know what a good family for me is. But you know, other people might not have a faith, so they might do other things, but they feel they have a good family.
The hallmark, I think, of a good family, we can all agree, is if the eldest boy goes to Georgia Tech for college.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Georgia Tech, not Kentucky? I don't know.
No, yeah.
Georgia Tech, right? Yeah.
Right. So do you have to work with DCFS at all? Because I found them to be the most unproductive, destructive organization I've ever seen in my entire life. But do you guys have to work with them, or...
I'm just going to say yes.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. Yes,
so
you
that's
have
where
to work
I mean,
with them.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's sort of like a lead generation, right? That's, they come to us to either put the kids in residence if they need that, or to help them find foster homes. And that
sounds nice.
it's tough.
Well, so what is the overall biggest challenge, or maybe the recurring challenge that, you know, people would think would be relatively easy to address, but it just turns out not to be?
the system right now is broken.
Yes.
And there are some good people at DCFS.
There are. Some wonderful caseworkers, and then there's some monsters.
Yes. Like in any organization.
Like in conservative talk radio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The monster.
Yeah.
We've been truly blessed to we have corporate partners for donations. We are well above our goals in last year over year. The money has come in. The challenge is having foster applicants, foster family applicants. The way that we work it, our conversion of getting an applicant into being certified is pretty high. We're well over 50%. It's about a 2-month process. You do background checks and you get trained and all of that. But
that actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that it would be a challenge getting families like Amy's that want to foster because you have so many families that are headed by a single parent.
Right.
And so, you know, they don't have the wherewithal to think about bringing in kids that are not their own to their home. And when you're talking about the out of wedlock birth rates across the board, that certainly starts to limit the pool pretty quickly.
Surprisingly, you don't need a nuclear family to become a foster family.
No, I understand. Right? But I mean, it's still I would just think it stands to reason that it would be more challenging.
It's certainly, you know, I was, again, raised by a single mom, so that's tough.
Yeah.
If you ask the kids, would you rather be in a foster home with a single mom or a single dad or in the system, they would rather
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So
that's also a commentary on the system, as you were talking about.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, but foster families come in all shapes and sizes. You could live in an apartment with two kids and be a single parent and be accepted to be a foster parent because, you know, they do the background checks. But if you have a loving home, that's really all these kids want is
how
a loving home.
How much politics is there? And I'm thinking specifically racial politics, like that there is a predisposition that white kids go with white families, or black kids go with black families, and they really try to avoid any sort of interracial arrangements.
About half of the kids who leave their home because of the parents, an abusive or unhealthy relationship, half of those go to other family members. It could be aunts, uncles, grandparents. It's often grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And that has its own challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But we do see success when a child of color is living with a very white family, whether it's in the city or whether it's in the burbs. It could be up in Winnetka or it could be down in Oak Lawn. So it works.
But is there any pressure on you from DCFS?
No.
To, there's
no.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't notice no pressure. But how many of your kids get adopted? Like they go into the foster care system and then get adopted or they're younger?
We're not an adoption agency.
Okay.
But we do know that we have had foster children become adopted, but that it's a low minority. It's less than 15%.
Mm.
But these kids are happy to be
in a foster
safe foster home, and the adoption, I mean, that's a dream to them, right? But whether you adopt someone or you foster them, we have several employees at Lydia that are foster parents and have done it for decades, and you know, they're 40-year-old former foster kids who are still a part of that family. So you don't need to be adopted to be loved.
Sure.
You know.
And so Lydia Home, I mean, again, as you mentioned, been around for more than 100 years and so served thousands upon thousands of kids over that time. So what's the vision now? People say, I want to get involved with Lydia Home. I want to support Lydia Home because I know it's going to help Chip and his team do X? What is X?
There's a lot of ways to help. One is money, but I could have all the money in my coffers, but I can't buy foster families. So I would say in order of priority, it would be foster families, mentors who can walk along the children, and then volunteers. But the inverse, I think, is more realistic, where, you know, volunteers can catch the bug and really understand the mission once they start being around these kids. These kids are lovable. They often feel hopeless, but with if you're just a good person and you allow yourself to really be impacted, you can make a difference. So asking for foster families, that's a big ask, but I the likelihood of having a volunteer or a mentor strongly consider being a foster parent, that's the sustainable way to grow that list.
He is Chip Borkowski. He's the director of development with Lydia Home. That's lydiahome.org. Lydiahome.org is the website for more information on Lydia Home, and we'll be talking about it more over the next several weeks, actually, in the lead up to our golf tourney.
Yeah, because our golf tournament is benefiting Lydia Homes, and we have a morning and afternoon shotgun start. We'll be playing in the afternoon, so if you want to compete against us, if you want to golf in the morning, you will get breakfast. If you golf in the afternoon, you can join us for dinner. All golfers will enjoy lunch, and we have prizes for, you know, the things. But as a way of saying thank you, we'll give you 25 one-minute commercials to air right here on AM 560 to promote your business. So it's a win-win for everybody, a win for Lydia Home, and a win for your business. And to sign up for our golf tournament, go to am560.com/golf.
Chip Borkowski, Director of Development, Lydia Home. Chip, thanks for joining us. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.